3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast, episode 56, Apollo 4, All Up Test. By May 1967, NASA was ready to move on from the tragedy of the Apollo 1 fire. Prior to the fire in January 1967, NASA's plan had been to launch the first crewed Apollo mission as early as February 1967. After the fire, that schedule was obviously no longer valid. Months had to be spent investigating the cause of the fire. Months more were needed to redesign and correct the Apollo command module to address the fire problem. As a result, NASA needed to look to a goal other than a crewed mission as its next major step toward a moon landing. NASA's focus quickly turned to the launch of the Saturn V rocket as soon as possible. As it happened, all stages of the Saturn V rocket were becoming ready for flight testing by the spring of 1967. The Saturn V rocket was made of three stages. Starting from the bottom, the first stage was known as the S1C. That's the letter S followed by a dash, followed by a Roman numeral 1, followed by the letter C. The S1C was powered by 5 F1 rocket engines that together put out 7.5 million pounds of thrust. The F1 engines used liquid oxygen and kerosene as the propellants, the only stage of the rocket to use these propellants. The two upper stages would use liquid hydrogen. The S1C stage is the stage I have described the most in past episodes. The second stage was known as the S2 stage. That's the letter S followed by a dash followed by the Roman numeral 2. This stage was powered by 5 J2 engines, which used liquid hydrogen. The third stage was known as the S4B stage. That's the letter S followed by a dash followed by the Roman numeral 4, followed by the letter B. The S4B stage was powered by a single J2 engine that also used liquid hydrogen. Now, you might think that when the Saturn V rocket was designed, the design started from the bottom with the first stage and that the other two stages were developed based on that. In fact, the Saturn V rocket's stages were developed in reverse from the top down. Indeed, the development of the two liquid hydrogen-powered upper stages of the Saturn V rocket began before the development of the Saturn V rocket itself. Let me explain. NASA had been interested in developing a liquid hydrogen-powered rocket stage as early as 1959. Less than a year after the creation of NASA. In episode 43, I described how NASA's interest in liquid hydrogen-powered rockets led eventually to the Centaur rocket. I also described why liquid hydrogen was such an important rocket fuel to master, particularly for upper stage rockets. Hydrogen is both lightweight and burns efficiently, making it molecule for molecule the most efficient fuel. Another way to think of it is that liquid hydrogen offered the best fuel to payload ratio because it was the lightest fuel to carry on an upper stage and burned so efficiently. In 1959, NASA was debating the future development of heavy lift rockets. Keep in mind that during these debates in 1959, the Saturn V rocket was not a concept in existence yet. The debate was still mainly about the development of a rocket capable of 1.5 million pounds of thrust. As I mentioned in a couple of previous episodes, that 1.5 million pound of thrust rocket became the Saturn I rocket. During these early debates on heavy lift rockets, Abbe Silverstein argued that NASA should invest in developing liquid hydrogen powered upper stage engines for use in future heavy lift rockets. As a reminder, Silverstein is the one who later became director of the Lewis Flight Center in Ohio and completed the Centaur rocket. Von Braun initially resisted the development of new engines powered by such an experimental fuel, but he was eventually convinced that the benefits of liquid hydrogen justified the risk and expense involved in taming liquid hydrogen as a rocket fuel. When NASA made the decision to develop liquid hydrogen rocket engines, there was already one engine pretty far along in development. This was the RL-10 engine that was eventually used in the Centaur rocket. The RL-10, however, was at the time capable of only about 15,000 pounds of thrust. For a heavy lift rocket, NASA was thinking that the liquid hydrogen engine should put out about 150,000 to 200,000 pounds of thrust, more than 10 times more powerful than the RL-10. In September 1960, NASA awarded a contract to Rocketdyne to develop this new super powerful liquid hydrogen fueled rocket engine. This rocket engine would eventually be known as the J2 engine. The most interesting aspect of the contract for the J2 engine was not the technical requirement to use liquid hydrogen or even the high level of thrust demanded from the engine. No, it was the fact that the contract called for an engine designed to specifications that would, quote, ensure maximum safety for manned flight, end quote. The reason this is so interesting is that when the J2 engine contract was signed in September 1960, it was 7 months before President Kennedy announced the race to the moon. Already, even at this early stage, NASA had big plans in mind for the future of liquid hydrogen rocket stages. The reference to a manned spaceflight in the contract also meant that from day one, the J2 engine would be designed and engineered to the highest specifications. This was in contrast to other rockets, such as the Atlas or Titan missiles, which were initially designed as ballistic missiles or missiles to carry satellites and later converted for manned spaceflight. Although NASA awarded the contract to develop the J2 engine in September 1960, it was unclear where exactly the J2 engine would go in NASA's plans for future rockets. Not until July 1962, after NASA made the decision to proceed with Lunar Orbital Rendezvous for the Apollo lunar landing, did NASA have a role for the J2 engine. To explain this, I need to back up a little again. Initially, NASA's first heavy lift rocket would be the Saturn I rocket. As I explained in episode 48, when I discussed the F1 engine, The Saturn I rocket was a stopgap measure to provide the United States with a heavy lift rocket as soon as possible in light of Sputnik. As a result, the Saturn I rocket's first stage did not utilize the radical new F1 engine. Instead, NASA and Von Braun decided to modify an existing rocket engine into the H1 engine. Then they clustered 8 H1 engines to make the Saturn I rocket's first stage. The second stage of the Saturn I, meanwhile, would be powered by a liquid hydrogen-fueled rocket stage known as the S4. That is the letter S followed by a dash followed by the Roman numeral 4. But again, because NASA was focused on using existing equipment to provide a heavy lift rocket as soon as possible, NASA used the RL-10 engine, which, as I mentioned just a moment ago, was significantly less powerful than the J-2 engine. Prior to July 1962, when NASA decided to use Lunar Orbital Rendezvous, the Saturn I rocket had an important role in the Apollo program. The Saturn I was not strong enough to carry astronauts all the way to the moon, but it was powerful enough to launch the Apollo spacecraft into Earth orbit, where astronauts could train with the spacecraft and NASA could acquire operational experience. When NASA decided to go with Lunar Orbital Rendezvous, however, the Saturn I rocket was no longer sufficient even for this limited Earth orbital role. NASA would need to launch a command module, a service module, and the lunar module into Earth orbit in order to test out all of the spacecraft, to allow the astronauts to train, and to acquire operational experience. The Saturn I rocket was not powerful enough to lift all three Apollo spacecraft modules into orbit at the same time. NASA decided to solve the problem by creating an uprated version of the Saturn I rocket, known as the Saturn I-B. The biggest difference between the Saturn I and the Saturn I-B was the liquid hydrogen-fueled second stage. On the Saturn I, the S4 second stage had been powered by 6 RL-10 liquid hydrogen-powered engines for a total of 90,000 pounds of thrust. For the Saturn I-B, there would be a new second stage, known as the S4B, which I mentioned at the top of the episode. The S4B would be powered by a single J-2 engine for 200,000 pounds of thrust. That would be enough to carry all three Apollo spacecraft modules into Earth orbit. Now, you might be wondering why NASA didn't just plan on using the Saturn V rocket to carry the Apollo spacecraft into Earth orbit. The biggest issue here was timing. At the time in 1962, the Saturn V development was just beginning, and NASA was unsure when the F1 engine would be ready. The more modest Saturn I-B would be ready earlier, and that would allow NASA to start putting Apollo spacecraft into orbit for flight qualification before the mission to the moon. There was also a cost issue. The Saturn I-B was going to be cheaper to manufacture and launch than the massive Saturn V. The development of the S-4B second stage for the Saturn 1B rocket also had a major benefit for the development of the Saturn V rocket. NASA decided that the S-4B, in addition to being the second stage of the Saturn 1B, should also be the third stage of the Saturn V. Because of the S-4B's use on the Saturn 1B rocket, the S-4B actually became the most tested, most used, and most reliable of all the Saturn V rocket stages. The reliability of the S-4B was a very good thing, because this stage of the Saturn V rocket played an absolutely critical role. As the third and final stage of the Saturn V, the S-4B had two responsibilities. First, the S-4B was to place the Apollo spacecraft into a final, stable orbit around the Earth. Second, the S-4B was supposed to perform the translunar injection. That is, accelerating the Apollo spacecraft so that they become free of the Earth's gravity and head toward the moon. The S-4B also needed the capability to restart in space. After firing the first time to place the Apollo spacecraft in Earth orbit, the S-4B would shut down and coast in Earth orbit for about 4.5 hours. That is, until ground control was ready to authorize the translunar injection maneuver, which would require the S-4B to restart its engine. Because the S-4B was made up of only a single J-2 engine, this was one area of the Apollo mission profile that had the possibility of a single point failure. If the J-2 engine on the S-4B did not restart, that was it. The astronauts were not going to the moon. To ensure that the J-2 engine would restart in zero gravity, NASA had to ensure the proper eulage of the propellants. Eulage, in this case, refers to maintaining proper orientation so that the propellants stay at the bottom of the fuel tanks, so that the rocket engine will actually fire again. Only after the translunar injection procedure would the Apollo spacecraft finally separate and discard the S-4B, ending the Saturn V's portion of the mission. The second stage of the Saturn V rocket, the S-2 stage, had a similar, though slightly different, development history than the S-4B, even though both rocket stages used the same liquid hydrogen-powered J-2 engine. The outlines of the S-2 stage started to take shape way back in December 1959. When Abbe Silverstein argued in favor of developing liquid hydrogen-fueled upper-stage rockets. As I said, within a year after that, in September 1960, NASA awarded the contract for the J-2 engine to Rocketdyne. Although the contract for the liquid hydrogen-powered J-2 engine had been awarded in September 1960, NASA did not have an actual rocket that would use the engine yet. Work on the actual rocket design took a little more time and occurred in parallel as work on the J-2 engine began. A year later, in September 1961, NASA awarded a contract to develop the actual rocket stage, the S-2, to North American Aviation. The S-2 would use 5 J-2 engines to put out a total of 1 million pounds of thrust. The development of the S2 stage encountered quite a few problems. These problems centered around the size of the rocket stage and the use of liquid hydrogen fuel. The S2 was about 10 meters in diameter, or about 33 feet. This was the same diameter as the first stage of the Saturn V rocket, but nearly twice as wide as the third stage, the S4B, which was about 6.6 meters or 23 feet in diameter. If you look at a model or diagram of a Saturn V rocket, you'll actually see a part where the rocket tapers. This is where you can find the dividing point between the second stage S2 and the third stage S4B. The fabrication of large fuel tanks that fit into the 10 meter diameter S2 stage was quite problematic. New welding techniques had to be developed because of the size of the tanks, and the need for the tanks to maintain structural integrity. Because the Saturn V had to be man-rated, the welding process had to pass incredibly stringent inspection procedures. The welding basically had to be perfect. Now, at the time in the early 1960s, the state of the art was capable of making perfect welds for a length of about a few centimeters. Because of the size of the S2 fuel tanks, however, NASA required that perfect welds extend for dozens of meters. This required manufacturers to embark on a series of empirical welding experiments until they found a method that reliably produced perfect welds. The use of liquid hydrogen in the S2 only made the manufacturing process so much more difficult. Liquid hydrogen is far less dense than other types of rocket fuel, such as kerosene. Due to the low density of liquid hydrogen, the fuel tanks actually had to be made even larger to carry more of this low density fuel. The size of the fuel tanks, in turn, started to create unacceptable weight penalties on the rocket stage and the rocket's aerodynamic nature. To address the weight and size issue, North American Aviation decided to eliminate the intertank. So let me explain again. The S2 stage carried both liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. Both are necessary propellants to the rocket. Liquid oxygen is the oxidizer, and liquid hydrogen is the fuel. The two propellants, however, are stored at very different temperatures. Liquid oxygen is stored at minus 183 degrees Celsius, or about minus 297 degrees Fahrenheit. Liquid hydrogen is stored at minus 253 degrees Celsius, or about minus 423 degrees Fahrenheit. Both are very, very cold, but there is a difference of more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit between them. Due to the temperature differences of the two propellants, the original plan was to separate the tanks for each propellant by an empty intertank. This empty intertank would help insulate the liquid hydrogen from the liquid oxygen and vice versa. With the size and weight restrictions, however, North American decided to eliminate the intertank. Liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, which had more than 100 degrees temperature difference, now had to share a common wall. North American eventually developed a honeycomb structure in the common wall to help keep the propellants insulated from one another. But development of the S2 became so problematic that it eventually became the pacing item for the Saturn V rocket. That is, it was the stage that was lagging behind the most. The problem was making sure that the large fuel tanks remained structurally sound, especially after loading them with frigid liquid hydrogen, which had a tendency to make the metal in the fuel tanks brittle. For example, on May 28, 1966, the development of the Saturn V rocket suffered a significant setback when an S2 stage exploded on a test stand. The explosion occurred when technicians conducting a pressure check to make sure the liquid hydrogen fuel tank was structurally sound. To do this, the technicians filled the fuel tank with helium. Unbeknownst to them, the sensors checking for pressure had been turned off. As a result, the liquid hydrogen tank became overpressurized and exploded, injuring 5 technicians. Although the explosion had been caused by accidental overpressurization, the subsequent investigation found tiny cracks in the liquid hydrogen fuel tank. This led to further inspections of the manufacturing process, which found even more tiny cracks in other fuel tanks. This, in turn, led to a series of modifications in the manufacturing process and repairs to existing fuel tanks. But the problem with the S2 fuel tanks continued. In January 1967, North American delivered the first S2 stage to Cape Canaveral. Although this delivery initially created optimism that the Saturn V rocket could be tested soon, inspections at the vehicle assembly building uncovered numerous problems. One major problem was the emergence of hairline fractures in the propellant tanks. The discovery of these hairline fractures led to further tests using dyes and X-ray inspection of welds, which uncovered even more imperfections that required further repairs to the tanks. Because of these last-minute fixes, the S2 stage was the last stage to be made ready for the first Saturn V launch. Correcting the fractures in the S2 propellant tanks was particularly nerve-wracking for North American. Remember that North American also manufactured the Apollo Command Module. And in the aftermath of the Apollo 1 fire in January 1967, North American was under intense scrutiny. The discovery of fractures in the S2 tanks, also manufactured by North American, in the spring and summer of 1967, only increased the scrutiny on North American's quality control capabilities. This in turn led to changes in the management at North American and a reorganization of the whole company. In short, it was a stressful time, an uncertain time to be working for North American Aviation. Then there was the first stage of the Saturn V rocket, the S1C. Now, I've already discussed this stage in episode 48 on the F1 engine, as well as a few other episodes. In short, however, Wernher von Braun and his engineers at the Marshall Space Flight Center had been drawing up a number of designs for heavy lift rockets. In one of the initial configurations, the rocket stage that would become the S1C had 4 F1 engines for a total of 6 million pounds of thrust. In late 1961, NASA was working to finalize the design for the Saturn V moon rocket following President Kennedy's State of the Union address to land on the moon before the end of the decade. NASA's initial decision was to proceed with the four-engine configuration for the S1C. But by the end of 1961, that decision was modified to a five-engine configuration. There were multiple reasons for the five-engine configuration. For one thing, the additional thrust offered by a fifth engine made Lunar Orbital Rendezvous one of the possible modes for getting to the moon. At the time, in late 1961, NASA had not yet made the definitive choice to go with Lunar Orbital Rendezvous, but having a fifth engine made the option viable. A fifth engine also improved structural integrity of the S1C. In the four-engine configuration, the engines would be attached using a pair of crossbeams. In the four-engine configuration, something would need to be done to hold the crossbeams together. But in the five-engine configuration, the fifth engine would be in the center of the two crossbeams and provide the additional material needed to hold the crossbeam structure together. On December 15th, 1961, NASA awarded the contract to build the S1C to Boeing. As I said, this rocket stage would be the only rocket stage of the Saturn V rocket to use kerosene and liquid oxygen, rather than liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen as the propellants. One final aspect of the Saturn V rocket that must be discussed is the instrument unit. The instrument unit was almost like a stage of its own. The instrument unit was a hollow ring at the very top of the Saturn V rocket. It would be sandwiched between the S4B stage and the Apollo spacecraft. The instrument unit ring was about 7.6 meters in diameter and about 1 meter tall. The instrument unit was effectively the brain of the Saturn V rocket. It contained all the computers, gyroscopes, and other equipment necessary to fly a proper trajectory. The instrument unit provided the rocket with guidance and control during all phases of flight. For example, the unit was responsible for calling for engine shutoff and separation of expended stages. The unit was also provided the data necessary for key aspects of the mission, such as translunar injection. During a launch, the instrument unit would activate 5 seconds before liftoff. The instrument unit would then begin executing the first in a series of pre-programmed attitude maneuvers. After flying for about 12 seconds, the computers in the instrument unit would use all the data it had collected on the roll and pitch of the rocket to activate the gimbals on the F1 engines. These gimbals basically allow a slight change in the direction of the engine thrust. Using the gimbals, the instrument unit would start to roll the entire rocket as it flew upward to ensure it stayed in the proper trajectory. As the Saturn V continued on its way to space, the computers in the instrument unit would constantly check the rocket's position and flight conditions and compare those to the optimum conditions desired by its programming. So by early 1967, all parts of the Saturn V rocket were delivered, or in the process of being delivered, to the Kennedy Space Center on Merritt Island, where they would be stacked in the vehicle assembly building at Launch Complex 39. It is worth talking for a moment about the delivery of these various parts, because designing and manufacturing the Saturn V rocket stages was not the only thing that took a fair amount of time. Time that needed to be accounted for if NASA was going to land on the moon before the end of the decade. The first stage of the Saturn V, the S1C, as well as the instrument unit, were manufactured in Michoud near New Orleans, Louisiana. The S1C was then tested in Huntsville, Alabama, or alternatively, the Mississippi Test Center. The primary means of transporting the S1C stage and the instrument unit from this region in the southern United States to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida was by barge. A barge would carry these stages down the Mississippi River along the south coast of the United States and around the Florida Peninsula along the Intercoastal Waterway. The entire journey took about 2 weeks. This was a valuable amount of time, especially given the significant number of events that need to be coordinated for a rocket launch. In fact, in one case, when preparing for a Saturn 1B launch in early 1966, NASA realized that there was not enough time to finish the instrument unit to launch on time. The engineers, however, worked out a way to save time by continuing work on the instrument unit while it sat on the barge during the 2 week journey. Keep in mind that working on the instrument unit during the journey on the barge was not easy. The instrument unit had to be set up inside a clean room to protect the computers and electrical equipment. They also had to stay in radio contact with the manufacturing plant to make any emergency deliveries in the event that they needed a specific part to complete their work. Delivery of the second stage, S2, and the third stage, S4B, was even more problematic. Both rocket stages were manufactured all the way out in California. The S2 was manufactured at Seal Beach, while the S4B was manufactured in Huntington Beach. Both cities are just south of Los Angeles. Initially, the only way to get the S2 and the S4B stages from Southern California to Florida was by water. Barges would carry these rocket stages along the east coast of the Pacific Ocean to the Panama Canal. The barges would then cross the canal and then head back north, hugging the coast of the Gulf of Mexico all the way to Louisiana. From there, they would be shipped up the Mississippi River to Huntsville or the Mississippi Test Facility to pass tests. Once that was done, the barges could carry them along the coast again, around the Florida Peninsula, along the Intercoastal Waterway to the Kennedy Space Center. Needless to say, this was an especially time-consuming journey that could seriously impact the timetable for launches. To help with the logistics, NASA eventually invested in a proposal by the entrepreneur John M. Conroy. Conroy had modified a Boeing 377 Stratocruiser so that it would be large enough to carry rockets. The modifications led to an aircraft with a bulbous fuselage. Going nearly bankrupt after making these modifications, Conroy finally convinced NASA to invest following a dramatic demonstration of the aircraft's capabilities, after many had raised questions about whether such a plane could even fly. During the demonstration, some commented that the aircraft looked like a pregnant guppy, and that name stuck. Later, an improved version of the aircraft would be developed called the Super Guppy. You can see photos of these aircraft in the link in the episode description. The pregnant guppies began operations in 1963. They were capable of carrying the S-4B rocket stage from California all the way to testing facilities in Alabama and Mississippi, and then onward to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. These flights shaved weeks off launch schedule preparations. The guppies, however, were not large enough to carry a full S-2 stage. Those still had to be carried by ship from California. And you can actually see photos of these ships that carried the S-2 in the link in the episode description as well. By the spring of 1967, all parts of the Saturn V rocket had arrived at Launch Complex 39. Now, all that was needed was to assemble the Saturn V rocket, and then the launch could occur. So it was at this time in the spring of 1967 that NASA announced that the first Saturn V launch would be called Apollo 4. At the same time, the mission in which Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee had died in a fire was retroactively called Apollo 1. No missions were designated Apollo 2 or 3. The reasons for this seem to have been an effort by NASA to put some distance between the fire and the start of Apollo missions. Actually assembling the Saturn V rocket for the first time proved somewhat difficult, however. As the assembly began, NASA discovered over 1,200 problems. Each problem required quite a bit of time for follow-up work to ensure that the Apollo 4 and future missions would be a success. For example, one typical problem encountered was the discovery of a loose bolt in one of the F1 engines in the first stage. This led to an investigation as to how the loose bolt got there in the first place so that it would not happen again. Then there were the fractures found in the second stage of the S-2 propellant tanks that had to be fixed. But on August 26, 1967, the first Saturn V rocket rolled out from the vehicle assembly building toward the launch pad. The launch of this 36-story tall rocket was going to accomplish quite a few firsts. For one thing, the Apollo 4 mission marked the first flight test of the first stage S1C and the second stage S2. The third stage, S4B, was the only part of the new rocket that had been launched before, on top of a different rocket, the Saturn 1B. Because this was the first time that the first two stages would be flight tested, NASA was looking to confirm that a number of features on the two stages actually worked in practice. One major test, for example, was determining whether the gimbals on the F1 engines in the S1C stage could actually maneuver the Saturn V rocket during its climb. No one had ever tried to maneuver such a massive rocket with gimbaled engines before. NASA was also looking to see if the five J2 engines on the S2 second stage would all ignite. Because the S2 stage would not fire until the rocket was already at altitude in near weightlessness, there was some concern that the propellants might surge forward to the top of the tanks, which would make it hard for the J2 engines to ignite. Even on the third stage, S4B, the most tested part of the Saturn V, NASA was looking for confirmation of something new, namely whether the J2 engine on the S4B would ignite again after spending over 3 hours coasting in Earth orbit. Historically, rocketry shied away from testing so many new features at the same time. As I've mentioned before, rocket development tended to favor a process whereby one stage at a time would be tested in flight. Once each stage had been flight tested, they would then be combined for a single final test of the final rocket configuration. Stage-by-stage testing of the Saturn V rocket, however, was not an option due to budget and time constraints. If NASA had followed prior custom to perform stage-by-stage testing, NASA would have had to perform at least four different launches for the three-stage Saturn V. Those launches probably would have added about 12 months of flight testing to the Apollo schedule and would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars to complete. When George Miller took over as the director of the Office of Manned Spaceflight in 1963, he recognized that the Apollo program was falling behind schedule. They were not going to make President Kennedy's deadline to land on the moon before 1970. The only way he saw to fix this was to compress the Saturn V flight testing schedule by performing an all-up test. This was where all parts of the rocket would be launched at the same time in a single test. Miller also insisted on all-up testing in response to budget constraints. In the aftermath of President Kennedy's assassination in November 1963, the newly instated President Johnson faced pressure from Congress to rein in NASA's budget. NASA, under President Kennedy, had submitted a budget request totaling $5.75 billion. But Congress told President Johnson to keep the budget under $5 billion. In light of this pressure to cut funding, the move to all-up testing was also necessary to shave hundreds of millions of dollars off the Apollo program. In response, however, NASA repeatedly emphasized the importance of quality control and testing during the manufacturing process. On November 9, 1967, the gamble on all-up testing paid off. Apollo 4 lifted off from Launch Complex 39, carrying an updated Block 1 version of the command module. The Saturn 1C stage worked perfectly, and the F1 engines gimbaled properly to roll the entire rocket and pitch it into a northeasterly direction as it climbed away from the launch pad. Then, after the S1C stage separated, the five J2 engines on the second stage, S2, fired successfully. The S2 stage then separated, and the S4B stage placed the spacecraft into a stable orbit around the Earth. After coasting for 3 hours in space, the S4B's single J2 engine restarted. This was the first restart of the S4B in orbit. The Saturn V was not carrying a payload to the moon quite yet, however. For the Apollo 4 mission, rather than performing a translunar injection maneuver, the S4B propelled the command module into a highly elliptical orbit, more than 16,000 kilometers away from the Earth. The S4B then separated. At this point, the service module, connected to the Apollo command module, pushed the Apollo spacecraft out further to about 18,000 kilometers, where the command module spent about 4.5 hours exposed to high radiation levels. The next phase of the mission was to test re-entry. The command module was put in a power dive to re-enter the atmosphere at about 40,000 kilometers per hour. These speeds were to simulate the conditions of the command module during re-entry from the journey from the moon. 9 hours after launch, the command module splashed down in the Pacific Ocean. Apollo 4 was a significant step toward landing on the moon. The mission proved that the Saturn V rocket and the Apollo command module's re-entry system worked. The mission served to restore much of the confidence that had been lost in the wake of the Apollo 1 fire. The success of the Apollo 4 mission also began to raise alarm bells in the Soviet Union. The leaders of the Soviet space industry, such as Vasily Mishin and Vladimir Chelemy, had already been acknowledging quietly for the last several years that the United States was ahead of them in the effort to land on the moon. This was not something they said out loud, but it was understood. But they also thought that the Soviet Union always had a chance to catch up. In their projections for lunar landing missions, they always suggested that NASA would not be able to land on the moon until 1970 or 1971, after President Kennedy's deadline. If this projection was true, it meant that the Soviet Union still had a fighting chance to beat the United States to the moon, even if the Soviet Union was behind. But the Soviet projections of NASA's timeline to land on the moon was based on a critical assumption that NASA would encounter serious problems during the flight testing of the Saturn V rocket. The Apollo 4 mission, however, was almost flawless. NASA did not look like it was going to have to work out any serious rocket issues during Saturn V flight testing. This meant that the United States could very well land on the moon in 1969, something that people like Mishin and Chelemy had not believed was likely, or perhaps even possible. The Soviet designers could not be faulted for their logic. For the development of Korolev's N1 rocket, and even Chelemy's plans for the development of the competing UR-700 rocket, time had been allotted to work out problems that were discovered only during flight testing. They did not appreciate that NASA had put the Saturn V rocket through the most vigorous quality control and testing regime in the agency's history. And that was in part because the Soviets were not putting their own rockets through rigorous quality control during manufacturing, largely because they lacked the funding or the capabilities to do so. For now, however, the Soviet Union was not giving up on the moon. Not after the Soyuz 1 accident, and not after Apollo 4. In fact, the Soviet Union was about to start tests of its own moon rocket, the N1. More about that next time.